From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Happy Independence Day. Coming up in our second hour this morning, we're going to talk with historian Ray Raphael. His latest book is called The First American Revolution, Before Lexington and Concord, and he joins us after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. This is a special recorded edition of Forum, and happy 4th of July, and how appropriate on this Independence Day. We'll be able to talk with a historian who has what has been characterized and what he himself characterizes as a different lens of looking at the American Revolution. Ray Raphael is the author of a number of books. His first book was An Everyday History of Somewhere. It won the California Commonwealth Club Award for Best Book of the Year. It was about California, and that was the category. And in subsequent books, Edges, Cash Crops, Tree Talk, and More Tree Talk, he's done a lot to explore the area of Northern California where we live, also the author of In a Teacher's Voice. But what we're going to talk to him about today is the American Revolution. And he's done a book called A People's History of the American Revolution, which is now available in paperback. It's part of a series that Howard Zinn put together as senior editor. And he has also published The First American Revolution, Before Lexington and Concord. And if that sounds strange to your ears, well, we'll try to elucidate why that is indeed the case. And Ray Raphael, welcome. Glad to have you here.
I'm pleased to be here on the 4th of July.
And the 4th of July is when people are going to be hearing this. And let's talk about the 4th of July, because that really wasn't the revolution. The real revolution began, as you see it, about 7 months before that, as the crow flies?
The real revolution began the 4th of July, 1776, was when they signed the Declaration of Independence. And a year before that, a year and a couple of months before that, was what's known as the beginning of the revolution at Lexington and Concord, the shot heard round the world, which is where blood was first shed. But we have to go back even earlier. If you look at the history of common people and take common people seriously, which I do in both of these books, you have to go back earlier yet to find out when the real revolution actually happened.
And I said 7 months before. I meant 7 months before Lexington and Concord.
Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's 7 months before Lexington Concord, and exactly 21 months, really, before the Declaration of Independence, when the revolution started. And it started not in the way that most people think it did.
In fact, you say that Lexington and Concord was kind of a counter-revolution against the British, because the revolution had already begun.
That's correct. The revolution had begun. Here's what happens. In the summer of 1774... the British had just passed an act which basically disenfranchised all the people of Massachusetts. It deprived them of the power of their vote. And they rose up as a body to kick out all British authority. They just removed every crown-appointed official in one way or another was gone by the end of that summer. And the way in which they did this was fascinating, because they had no leaders, and they just operated according to their own self-interest, which was proclaiming that the British could not rule them. What they did is they were forbidden from having town meetings. That was part of the act. So what did they do? Of course, they had town meetings anyway. They had been meeting for 150 years in their town meetings and in their congregational churches. These were very collectively oriented people, so you can't just tell them not to have town meetings. That doesn't work. So they just had them anyway. So the governor tried to clamp down on them. But what's he going to do? He can't go out to every town and say you can't have a town meeting. So he finally says, well, how about we'll start in Salem? Salem was the provincial capital at the time, and they were meeting right down the street from where the governor was. So he says, okay, I'm going to stop them from having their town meeting. So he tries to do this, and he arrests a few of the people who had called that particular meeting. And no sooner does he do this than 3,000 farmers start coming at him from all around the countryside and basically spring the people from jail. The people who had been held in jail, the first two actually paid their bail, and the other says, not a 90th part of a farthing for the king. We're going to stay in jail, and we're not going to pay the king anything. And then here comes 3,000 farmers, and, of course, the men get released. Now, this is the beginning, but it goes on in all kinds of ways. All the crown-appointed officials get pressured to resign, sometimes individually. For instance, in Worcester, Timothy Paine 2,000 people show up at his house. And they show up at his house and they say, hey, you cannot serve under this new oppressive Massachusetts Government Act. You're out of here. And he says, okay, I'll write a piece of paper. So he writes a piece of paper and gives it to him. And they say, not good enough. Actually, when I say they say, he gave it to five people. The five people went out to the crowd, to these 2,000 people, and said, is this good enough? Because every decision during this entire process had to be made by all the people. And they turn it back. They said, nope, we need a second draft. That's not strong enough. So they make Timothy Paine write it again. So he writes it again, and then they take it out and they read it. And they say, well, the people say, okay, the text is good, but we want to see his face. So he has to come out while it's read. And then they say, well, basically the word is out to the people. Was that good enough? And they say, no, that's not good enough. He has to read it himself. So he reads it himself. And he thinks he's done. But then there's people in the back who can't hear. Wait a second, we can't hear. So he has to read it over and over, walk through these lines of people with his hat off, reading his resignation. And this happened to all this kind of event happened to all the counselors.
These officials having to take their hat off and show their submission?
That's right.
This became a kind of regular ritual.
It did. And that was the first recorded time of it. That was, and then it became, they seemed to like this process. So when it came time to basically, and that was to end the courts. See, he was a counselor. He was more or less like a senator, and he had been appointed by the crown. Previously, they had been elected.
No relation to Tom.
No relation to Tom. Previously, they had been elected. Now they were appointed, so they made him resign. And they made all of – there were 36 of these people, and 21 of them resigned. 15 didn't, and every one of those 15 had to retreat into Boston from out of the countryside and hide behind the British soldiers because, in fact, that's the only place where you could support Britain. By the end of this thing, by the way, Boston at that time had 5% of the population and it had the British Army. The other 95% of the population lived in the countryside, and which is what where today we would call it liberated. It was liberated countryside. So anyway, that was the counselors. They all had to resign one way or the other. Actually, the techniques varied. Sometimes somebody would just come to their church, and he would come into church, and as soon as he came in, the whole town walked out. Another time, he was a deacon in the church, and he read from the psalm. And as soon as he read the psalm, people were supposed to sing. Everybody quiet, deadly quiet. So in Congregational New England, where the Fellowship of Worship, these kinds of ostracisms, were the writing was on the wall. They had to either submit or leave, and they all did one or the other. But the real events, we haven't really started with a real revolution. The real revolution came when each court was to meet. And that was according to a set schedule, first at August 16th, 74, in Great Barrington, then in Springfield on August 30th, and then it's Worcester on September 6th, and so on down the line, all the county seats. Now, here's what would happen. In Worcester, for instance, the court was supposed to meet in the courthouse. Well, the Patriots showed up first, took control of the courthouse, and they made the court officials retreat into a local tavern halfway down Main Street. Meanwhile, here comes 4,622 militiamen into this small town of Worcester. Now, you have to understand that this is small town Massachusetts, rural Massachusetts, over 200 years ago. There's only 250 voters in Worcester. That's how many basically adult males there are. And here comes 4,622 people into town from 37 townships. And we know this because one of the participants, I actually found his diary in the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, Ebenezer Parkman, and it lists every one of these towns and how many people they sent. So these people line up along Main Street.
Would this work like the Crusades? I mean, just gathering more people as they went along? And...
Well, the word had been out, actually, because the resistance to this act, when people knew how oppressive this act was, they just mobilized, and the word was all out across the countryside, and everybody knew the appointed day, because everybody knew the court was supposed to meet in September 6th. And Gage, Governor Gage, who was both the governor and the commander-in-chief of the armed forces for the British Army, had said that he would support the court meeting in Worcester on September 6th. So these people knew, hey, this is going to be the big confrontation. They're going to the British Army is going to be there, and we're going to be there. So they had been mobilizing for this event all across the
country. How many British troops were there?
There were 3,000 British troops in Boston at the time. So the people in Worcester County...
So they had bigger militia numbers.
They had larger militia numbers. Mm-hmm. And Gage said he was going to come and support them. But something happened the week before that, which was there was a false rumor that the British had killed six people in a little skirmish in Cambridge and Charleston. And this is called the powder alarm. And as soon as this rumor spread into the countryside, somewhere between 20,000 and 100,000 patriots immediately mobilized and started marching to Boston. This is called the powder alarm. It was basically the false alarm for the American Revolution. And Gage saw this mobilization and said, uh-oh. He did a little bit of quick arithmetic, compared the numbers that people said were coming his way with his little 3,000 people. And he said, you know, I don't think I'm going to match up too well, particularly if I have to go out into the countryside where these people are. Now, these are just common farmers, you have to understand. They're not led by John Adams. They're not led by Sam Adams. They're not led by John Hancock. And all these famous revolutionary leaders are away in Philadelphia just talking about stuff at the First Continental Congress. And meanwhile, the farmers in their mud-cake boots are back there in Massachusetts saying, hey, there's no British authority here. Sorry, folks, you guys are out of there. So all from the 37 towns in Worcester County, remember, this is happening in all the different counties, but I'm just giving you Worcester because we know the numbers there, so it's kind of nice to talk about. From these 37 towns, the people gather, and they line up along Main Street. And actually, it takes a little while to get all positioned and everything because, remember, all decisions have to be made by all the people. So they elect their military commanders because these are militia units, and then they elect kind of a political representative. And these people get together, and they have a little committee to meet about a score of British-appointed officials who are huddling together in the tavern. But as soon as they do their little negotiations, they have to take it back to all 4,622 people in 37 companies all across town. And then they have to approve everything. So it takes the better part of the day. Finally, in the afternoon, they're ready. And they say, okay, you guys, time to come out. So they've written their resignations by this time, and they've been approved by the body of the people. And here they come, hats in hand, and each one starts reading his resignation. I promise I will never enforce the British Act, and I don't want to give any offense to my people, and so on like that. Things that were clearly not written by themselves, but which they had to sign. And they do this, and they do it. Each one has to read it 30 times as they walk the gauntlet through these patriotic militiamen from all over the countryside. And after that date, September 6th, there is no British authority anywhere in rural Massachusetts.
Thus the first American Revolution.
That is the first American Revolution. And this is one of the incredible stories that you learn when you just decide to take common people seriously. Very simple. I learned this when I wrote The People's History of the American Revolution. I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to shift my focus away from George Washington and the usual suspects and just go on over to his slaves and the Indians he displaced and the soldiers he commanded and all the common people of the Revolution. And I'm going to take their participation and their interests seriously. And when I do this, I find all kinds of incredible stories.
Well, in fact, in that book, you talk about the women spinning their own cloth as opposed to buying it from the British long before the Tea Party refusal of drinking tea because tea was supplied by the British. The kinds of things that really make up a revolt. And also, I think what's so striking about history from the standpoint of the people, and we'll get into, of course, the Native Americans and the slaves and so forth, because those are just extraordinary stories in the women. But it's not taught. It's not taught. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, you wonder why there's been the necessity. I mean, it's not to take anything away from the founding fathers and mothers, mostly fathers, of course. But I suppose in some ways this would shift the balance. I mean, and that is almost what you're trying to do in a way, to say that those characters, those larger-than-life characters, Jefferson and Sam mm-hmm. Adams and John Adams and so forth, are not the real revolution. The real revolution comes from the real folk.
The real folk, right. And one of the fascinating questions that emerges when you take the common people seriously and you see their incredible stories is why aren't we taught these stories?
Why is it? Does it sound subversive to people or something?
Yeah, well, it is kind of subversive. For instance, let's go back to this story of when the revolution started, That's the one I chronicle in the book that just came out, The First American Revolution Before Lexington Concord. Because that story is, I mean, it's so overpowering, and it's so obvious. I mean, all you have to do is read the story, see the story, and you say, of course, this is what happened. Why isn't it in the books? And what you see is that the people, the leaders at the time, had that very definite reasons for not wanting to focus on this thing. They didn't like that first American Revolution. It was too much of a revolution. And ever since that time...
Or they feel it could replicate itself against them?
Yeah, I think so. And then, and also, politically, these farmers were moving too quickly for them. They were being politicians, and they wanted to get support from all the colonies. And these guys were just saying, hey, we're moving right away. So you have letters from John Adams and Sam Adams... right at the time, to their people, they're writing from Philadelphia, and they're writing to their people back in Boston. They're saying, hey, can you try to slow these people down? They're scaring people away. But all the if you look at the reasons why the people's history isn't told, for instance, on the first American Revolution, you get to some really into the fundamental character of how history gets made. For instance, one reason we don't know about the first American Revolution is because there were no leaders. And that means there were no self-promoting individuals. There were no John Adams who wrote reams and reams about everything he did. So we don't have the sources, and we don't have those kind of protagonists that we liked in our narrative history.
We need the characters up on the pedestal, I guess. You need the mythic characters.
Yeah, you want a mythic character, and you want a hero. And another thing about a hero is a hero acts one against many. That's what a hero means. A real revolution is the many. And that's what this people's revolution was. The first American Revolution was a people's revolution. It was the many against the few. So it was really a very bullying revolution. And these people, I mean, check this out. Which makes better press for the Americans? A handful of sleepy-eyed farmers get mowed down by British red-coated regulars on the Lexington Green and are therefore victimized, or 4,622 militiamen gang up on 20 unarmed British-appointed officials in Worcester and force them to submit and humiliate themselves. Well, that one doesn't garner support because you want to be the victims. That's how you kind of work your propaganda. So, in fact,
apropos of that, in the first book, A People's History of the American Revolution, you chronicle, we'll get into how you find so much of your source material and so forth, but you chronicle a man in East Haddam who was just kind of rhetorically defending the crown, and go into a cataloging of what was done to him by the people. Now, we like to, mm-hmm. of course, again, mythologize our revolution and think of these patriots as having been heroes and the mythical characters and everything. There were good guys and bad guys mm-hmm. on both sides, as you might imagine, and as you make the case for. And it might be instructive just to talk about this one case, because what was done to this guy was just so egregious, only because he spoke in favor. He was a loyalist,
right.
You know, he was a traditional loyalist.
And there were all kinds of very grisly punishments meted out. In this case, there was hog dung thrown. I think that was the one with the hog dung.
Yeah, that was the hog dung, right.
Slightly more common was the tar and feathering. But all of these things have to do with barnyard symbolism, by the way, all these humiliations.
And scatological.
Exactly. So the... This revolution, once again, it's kind of a bullying revolution, and as revolutions are. And the strange thing about the American Revolution is that we don't want that conception of ourselves. We want to be the poor victims. So I just saw a textbook for kids, and it says, learn how a few brave patriots stood off the many in the British. Well, what do you mean a few brave patriots? I mean, like in this first American Revolution, you had upwards of 95% of the population supporting it, and the British were mercilessly hounded. But we like to conceive of our revolution as kind of immaculate conception. Right. It's just like
against the odds, really. Though.
Against the odds.
And against the hegemonic power of the British,
and
which was considerable.
And that is true. That is true that they had the biggest army and all that kind of thing. But the idea that we were somehow just the poor victims and we didn't bully the people around and make a forceful revolution, that's simply not true.
You're spoiling all these people who love that Mel Gibson movie.
right. Yeah, the Mel Gibson movie, notice that it is true. He very accurately portrayed some of the atrocities that occurred by the British. and then very inaccurately said that none of these were done by the Americans. Now, it doesn't take much of a student of history to see that usually these things are reciprocated.
Talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Ray Raphael, and his books include A People's History of the American Revolution, as well as The First American Revolution on this July 4th, a very different perspective of the American Revolution indeed, and a different perspective because Ray Raphael goes to some pains to make us see things through the eyes not only of the common people who fought the war, and as many of you probably know, it was a war fought by common people, largely because those who weren't so common or those who had the money could get somebody to go out and substitute and fight for them, right up through the Civil War, in fact, that was common practice. And this is a war that was our first Civil War, as Ray Raphael calls it. Only perhaps the Civil War itself was more deadly than this war. But it was also a war fought by those whose perspectives we often don't hear. That is, Native Americans and blacks were also involved. And the story of the slaves, of course, is also one that's been mythologized, that slaves, of course, wanted this revolt to take place. Mm-hmm. So many of the slaves fought on the side of the British because they thought the British were going to give them freedom, right?
One of the incredible aspects of the movie The Patriot was the happy, smiling slaves eagerly fighting on the side and supporting their patriot masters. Now, this, in fact, sorry, folks, is not the way it happened. Yes, so in the People's History of the American Revolution, you can see the list of 17 of George Washington's slaves. We have their names and brief descriptions of them who ran to the British to seek their freedom because the British promised them their freedom. 30 of Jefferson's slaves ran to the British to seek their freedom. So, in fact, the fact is that it was a war of liberation for the slaves, but it was personal liberation. And it was a liberation which was yet more powerful than the liberation sought by their patriot masters. And what I do in the book, in The People's History, is I actually look at the whole story from their perspective and talk about the ways in which they used the war to try to find their own liberation.
Well, the story that stood out for me was the story of a fellow named Ned Griffin who decided that he was going to fight on the side of the patriots and was promised freedom as a result and had nothing on paper, so he didn't get his freedom.
That's right.
Probably a common kind of case. Huh?
Yeah. Ned Griffin was from the Upper South, and there was some there, but very common in the North, where people would actually sign up to serve in the Army in return for a promise of their freedom. And those who got it in writing generally got it honored, but not all got it in writing. And even some in writing, they tried to retract it. After the war, people tried to claim the slaves back, and there were actually court cases coming from this. And some won and some lost.
Some amazing stories here. I mean, also, we talk about promises made in terms of fighting. There's the story of the Iroquois, corn planter, and mm-hmm. Winds up capturing his own father, finds out it's his father.
That's right, his own father, John O'Bale, an Irishman. He was a corn planter, was a half Irish and half Iroquois, but he lived all his. Of course, the dad was an absentee dad, and corn planter was a very respected Iroquois warrior. So he captures his father. What's he going to do? What's he going to do with his father? Is he going to take him as a prisoner of war and do whatever the Iroquois warriors do with him, or is he going to let him be? And this story happened often. The Iroquois nation was split in the war. Four of the nations sided with the British and two with the Americans. And there's another story of a brother capturing a brother. What's he going to do? And I'm not going to tell him.
No, leave it in suspense, Lady and the Tiger type of thing. We'll leave it as a suspense. In fact, we're going to have to go to a break anyway. But when we return, more about perhaps a different kind of American Revolution than you learned about in your school books. People's History of the American Revolution and the First American Revolution are Ray Raphael's books. And we'll talk with him more on this July 4th. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and welcome. Happy Independence Day. This is a July 4th pre-recorded broadcast with Ray Raphael talking about the American Revolution. Ray Raphael's books include A People's History of the American Revolution, How Common People Shaped the Fight for Independence, and the newer one, The First American Revolution, Before Lexington and Concord. And definitely, as I said, a different way of looking from the perspective and from really the eyes of those whose histories we usually don't involve ourselves with when we study the revolution. We see things. In fact, let's. I want to talk more about the Native Americans and the slaves, but also talk about women with you because they all prefigured the actual revolution itself. Women, particularly, played a significant role in terms of what came before the revolution and before Lexington and Concord.
Women played a very significant role. But when we discuss the roles of women that women did play, we have to break it down a little bit. Because the standard version, which is now taught in the textbooks and kind of politically correct, is that women supported the revolution by doing things like giving up tea for the boycott and giving up their fancy ornaments and things like this. And this is true for the women who drank tea and could give it up, and for the women who wore fancy ornaments and could give them up. But that's only one group, and I don't want to belittle their importance, because it was very important, and it was very important that people see that women did support the revolution. But it went a lot deeper than that, because lower-class women participated who didn't drink tea and couldn't give it up. Middle-class women, which is, of course, the bulk of them, participated basically by working. Now, I'm just talking about daily grind. If you have all these guys, in particular young guys, we're talking about the soldiers, by the way, in the revolution, were by and large very young. They were poor men and boys who did most of the fighting. And when I talk about boys, we're going all the way down to 11 years old. We have documented cases of people in battle at 11 years old, and drummer boys down to 7. But when these guys are going off, these are the main farm hands. These are the people who do a lot of the work around the farm. So who's left back at home to do the work? Well, the women are left back, and they shoulder more than their share of the burden. And when the British imports get taken away, I mean, through the non-importation before the war, who's going to make up the difference? Who's going to make that clothing and that yarn and then spin the yarn and make the cloth and make the clothes? The women are. So they have to go into double time, overtime. It's kind of they're basically in a speed-up operation. The workers are in a speed-up.
What about also just the general attitude of women toward revolt before the revolution even took place? I mean, there was a good deal of, I suppose, at that time, like there always has been, pillow talk or something, we could use euphemistically for the influence that women had on the men that they were with, and certainly many of them didn't want to be subservient to the crown and wanted the freedom.
Yeah, we do have indication that that particularly at the beginning of the war, the women were every bit as adamant and fervent about going after their rights as the rights of the when I say their rights, I mean that includes women.
They didn't get the vote till 1920.
They didn't get the vote, but you see, but you have to break it. It breaks down differently because we're going to go back to this story that I started with on the first American Revolution. Now, these farmers are getting, they're very upset because they've lost their vote. Now, the women didn't lose their vote. Well, a few women lost their vote. Let me backtrack. Women with property could vote in Massachusetts at that time because it was actually most people own property, by the way. Mm-hmm. Most men own property and most families own property. So the property voted. So in Worcester, for instance, on the voting lists, I did a lot of my research in the town of Worcester. The voting lists in the late 1770s included 8 women.
Widows, probably.
Who were widows, yeah. Right. 7 were widows, and 1 was the wife of somebody who had been exiled in the war. Hmm. But she still owned property, so she could vote. But just so you don't get too excited, dead people could also vote.
That's been going on for years in American politics.
There were 11 estates that could vote. But anyway, these people could vote. But the women, you see, it's the vote, it was really the property that voted. And the property means like the family farm. Now, the man was actually casting the vote, but that vote would be cast in a way that would secure your interest and your rights, basically your right to continue with your farm. Now, they were very worried when the British took away the right of the vote that corrupt officials could come in and foreclose on them and kick them out. This was why they got so upset, that basically they could take away their animals, they could take away their land. Now, a woman is every bit as affected as a man by this, so they're acting much more as a unit than we think of today. And when they first mobilized, for instance, in the powder alarm...
I was just about to ask you.
Yeah, we see the women are very supportive, and they're rolling up all the little cartridges. You know, it takes a lot of work to roll those powder into cartridges, which is what you're going to need to fight, and the women are doing all that, and they're supporting their men. But the Patriots then, the Patriot propaganda took a hold of this, and they started running with it. And they said, oh, women are kicking the men out and even stronger than the men and making their sons go out and fight. And this is not the way it happened. And particularly as the war went on, and the war, it dragged on more and more and more, and it turned into a draft, and the men didn't want to fight, so it became a draft. The women likewise didn't want their particular men to fight. So instead of shaming the men into fight, which is kind of the traditional patriotic view of looking at women's participation, you actually have women pulling on their men, saying, no, we don't want my only source of support here at the farm to go away and leave me alone. They're pulling away.
Where were the Native Americans in all this? I mean, when this first powder thing started, for example.
Well, the Native Americans, it's like the women. You can't just talk about all women. You have to talk about farm women, rich women, poor women. Let me backtrack 1 second. The poor women, we forgot about them. We got the property owner. We started with rich women, then the property owners. Now we got the poor women, and they are. They turn it, a lot of these people have nowhere to go, and they actually, like the very poor men, join the army. And they become camp followers, and they go along with the army and do a lot of great contributions in all the material aspects of the army. But the same thing with the Indians. You can't just say that the Native Americans all did this or that. Every group, if a person didn't see himself as a Native American, they were part of they could be a Delaware or Shawnee, Cherokee.
Tribes, yeah.
They were a specific tribe, yeah. And each tribe had its own interest, and each of the people within that tribe had their own interest. So you have people arguing they became very politicized. Whatever happened in the end. All Indians became incredibly politicized in trying to determine how to play the revolution to their own advantage. So you have the Iroquois, as I mentioned, four of the nations going with the British, the two that were more tied with American interests because they had been affected by missionaries siding with the Americans. You have the Cherokees mostly going against the Americans. But then you have divisions within that. You have the old warriors who say, we can't fight the Americans head on because they're too powerful. And then you have the young warriors say, you guys are giving up too easy, the young Turks. And you have the Cherokee Nation actually splitting apart into two groups, the Chickamaugas those were the young Turks who wanted to fight at all costs, and the old, the more conciliating group that said, hey, we can only do what's possible, and they had to give in partway to the Americans. This is happening clear across the board. All Indians are arguing with each other within their own groups. They're trying to scope out how do we use this war to further our own sovereignty. So you have millions of small, well, not millions, that's an exaggeration, thousands of small wars of liberation, wars of national sovereignty going on during the American Revolution, simultaneously
yeah.
with the American Revolution, that are a part of the American Revolution. And the American Revolution is actually the largest Indian war in our nation's history. All these things about out west with the cowboys and the Indians and on the big vistas and everything, that those involve like one tribe or two tribes. This every Native American east of the Mississippi is directly affected by the American Revolution. So to write a history of the war and not take any notice of what's happening with the American Indians is like totally off base.
But again, it's a story that's not told. It's missing from so many of the school books. The other stories that are not told, first of all, you have Quakers and Moravians who were neutral during the American Revolution. By your numbers, about 80,000 opposed to the revolution religiously, which is one out of 30 free Americans. Now, that's pretty significant.
That's a lot. I mean, what would that be today? That would be a divide 30, what's that, 10 million or something, 8 million.
Just for
Americans.
Religious reasons against. And then you also have the stories untold. I mean, in terms of, and a lot of this is in your first book, but the militiamen who deserted by droves, the Continental soldiers who mutinied because of lack of food. This is not the picture you get in the school books.
Well, it's very complex. I mean, people were not all of one stripe. We have this kind of generic view of Americans. Oh, we all came here, and then everybody stood up together and opposed the British. And there were a lot of different people of a lot of different genders, ages, ethnicity, race, everything. And if you want to talk about a people's history, and you have to take all of these people seriously. Now, I want to say
excuse me. I know you have something to say, but where do you go for sources of this people's history? I mean, it is a different lens, and you have to go, obviously, to different sources than the kind of school books we're talking
about. Yeah, you have to be creative, because there are a few diaries for some people and a few reminiscences and so on, but a lot of these people, common people at the times, were illiterate. Now, sometimes you get lucky. For instance, slaves. We have a couple of narratives that were done after the revolution of slaves who had become preachers, and they basically gave their narratives to religious magazines for the British. And so we have their narratives. We have a few of these things. We have one great Indian narrative, which was dictated to his fellow Iroquois who could write some English. So it's all broken, but we have some direct sources. A lot of times you have to go to indirect sources. You have to go to things like what I call reflected images. Runaway slave ads is a great place to get information about slaves, for instance. And here's an idea of a reflected image for camp followers. Camp followers, remember, were those women who followed the army? Mm-hmm. These women didn't write. We have one oral testimony of a camp follower from the pension applications, so that's good. That's one statement. But we can find out other things, for instance, from George Washington. George Washington gave these orders on this was July 4th, 1777. So just as we are July 4th now, this was July 4th, 1777, which is the one-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. General orders from the commander-in-chief. No women shall ride in the wagons. Okay. He didn't want women to ride in the wagons because he wanted his barefooted soldiers to ride in the wagons and get a little relief. And he was kind of embarrassed by the whole women aspect of the army. So then about a couple months later, another order. Absolutely no women should ride in the wagons. And then a couple months later, women have to ride with the baggage. And then a year after that, they have to ride behind the baggage. And this goes on clear through the war until 1781. The one source that we have from the camp follower says that she rode in a wagon to Yorktown. So what do we learn from this? We learn that the camp followers are riding in wagons, that the men are permitting them to, probably even suggesting that they do, because they respect the women's work. We learn that the men are disobeying Washington's orders to pursue a course that they think is more humane and appropriate. So we learn a lot about common people just by reflected images from the sources of the elite.
You were going to say something before. It sounded like you had a caveat of some sort when we were talking about the whole range and diversity of the people who fought in this revolution and how different they were. You're about to add something.
Oh, well, that was a long time.
We lost it. But I'm sorry. I just had to ask you about sources because it was. But it's not only that we find in your work all of this information that we're not given about the revolution in terms of who the players were and the roles played by different groups and so forth. There are also just like individual stories, figures that you find and that you bring to our attention. And I'm talking about, James Barr with the bridge, for example. That's a great story. Or the other story you tell about the whistler on the waterfront, the guy who was the best whistler on the waterfront in Boston,
right.
and his role in the Tea Party. I mean, maybe I ought to tell that story because it's a story certainly worth telling. But these are stories that whoever heard of this in grade school or even in studying the revolution,
right.
Even serious students of history.
Now, let me say something here. I did remember what I was going to say, and it kind of reflects on this. The stories that you're referring to now, the people who don't read the book, they don't know what they are. They're all kinds of individual stories with individual people about the guy who was at the Boston Tea Party who got promoted to a position of leadership because he could whistle. He had nothing else recommending him, but he could whistle, and that was good in that kind of activity, clandestine activity aboard these ships. But these things, the treatment that these stories have gotten from the what you call the historical establishment is that these stories are peripheral, that they're cute, they're human interest, but they're kind of trailer.
The anecdotal, anecdotal.
Yeah. The last 5 minutes of the news, right, that we always have this stuff. And go ahead, tell your story in the last 5 minutes, but we get the first 25 minutes and all the headlines. Now, what I'm saying here is that you got to go a step beyond that. That if you neglect common people, you distort history. You don't just say, "Oh, we're leaving a few people out." You literally distort it. Now, I'm going to go back to the first American Revolution here, my latest work, because and I'm going to show you how history gets distorted by leaving out the common people. The typical version says that the American Revolution started after the Boston Tea Party, the British passed these oppressive acts The Boston Port Act was the main one and a few others. The Boston Port Act closed the Port of Boston. Then a lot of people came to the aid of Boston in kind of philanthropic gesture, and that sort of garnered support, and eventually enough Americans opposed the British and the revolution broke out. That's the traditional version. What actually happened is the Boston Port Act affected the people of Boston, and that's 5% of the people in Massachusetts. The Massachusetts Government Act affected 95% of the people in Massachusetts and caused people to rebel, actually rebel, create their own revolution, not for somebody else's behalf, but for their own behalf. They overthrew British authority, and that's the first American Revolution chronicles that we talked about at the beginning of the hour, how all the farmers lined up and kicked out all the British officials in Worcester, Springfield, Taunton, Concord, Salem, every county seat and every town across Massachusetts outside of Boston. Why is that story not told? Because you're not taking common people seriously. If you tell the story from the standpoint of John Adams, he wasn't there. He's just talking about stuff in Philadelphia while the farmers back here in Massachusetts are acting and engaging in a revolution. If you just agree to look at them, you change your protagonist. These people are no longer bit players doing some, quote, crowd actions that lead up to the revolution, because that's the only way these things are ever referred to. You see that these are the revolution, that the common people are overthrowing the government, and you have to rewrite your entire text. This is not peripheral. When you have the people overthrowing a government, don't tell me that that's a peripheral story. That's a revolution.
No, I'm quite in agreement with your thesis and would champion it, except I suppose what – maybe one is a caveat and one is just an almost knee-jerk intellectual reaction. I suspect when you put the emphasis on the masses, it makes a lot of people nervous. I mean, that gets back to just, you know, notions of neo-Marxism and infiltrating leftist ideas. But the other side of this is that maybe you take away from, in people's minds, the heroic and inspirational figures like Sam Adams and John Adams and so forth. Because, you know, Jefferson, I mean, these were people who certainly were the architects of the revolution and had a great deal to do with it, even though they weren't the rank and file and they weren't, you know, slogging through the mud and doing the work that needed to be done.
Well, we have, you look at our icon of the revolution. Here we are, July 4th. So what do we think of? We think of July 4th, 1776, with all the founding fathers standing around the table signing the Declaration of Independence, which, of course, didn't happen that way. That's the picture we see. They signed it sort of individually, hither, and that ceremony that we depict.
Nonetheless, a great document that we lionize.
The document is great, but our image of the revolution is these guys, these genteel people, lined up and signing a piece of paper. We're not talking about tar and feathering. We're not talking about poor people doing the fighting. We're not talking about all this kind of nitty-gritty real stuff of revolution. Because, in fact, we kind of like the image of a revolution without really having a revolution. And so we have a very complex relationship with the American Revolution.
Like the image rather than the substance again.
That's right. Yeah. The image rather than substance. In fact, America is not a very revolutionary country. If we talk about revolution today, it scares people. And yet we idolize the American Revolution as something different. But to do that, we soften it. We soften the blow. And if you look at common people, it takes that softness away. Now, one other thing. You said that these people are the founding fathers were the architects of the revolution, and this certainly most people will grant them that. I won't even grant them that much. I think that let's look at it this way. Was Lyndon Johnson the architect of civil rights? I ask you. No, he signed the Civil Rights Bill. He signed a couple of them.
Well, he certainly had more to do with implementing civil rights than anybody in the history
of
this country. Right?
And this is exactly – did he play a pivotal role in the civil rights movement? Yes, he did, because he was the man in power at the time when it finally broke over the top.
I think I know where you're going with this, and I'm just thinking that he was also the – or he or his writers or his handlers were the visionaries who said, we want to build a great society. To some extent, you can't take away from the founding fathers documents like the Declaration of Independence, which essentially were the visionary firmament upon which this revolution was built.
But they weren't that visionary. The Declaration of Independence was a compilation. Thomas Jefferson wasn't a writer. He was an editor. There were all kinds of local declarations of independence written by the people in the 6 months prior to Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, and these things were compiled. Basically, I mean, he's a wonder. He was a writer, but what I'm saying is it's not like he dreamed
writer
up
and
these,
an editor.
Yeah,
yes.
he not like he dreamed up these ideas. He took from here and there and put them in a masterful form.
Well, nor did Johnson dream up the Great Society.
He
right?
didn't dream but, it up. Yeah. What happened is all those people in the South. I was in the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, and I went down there as from the North, and the people, and when I went down there, I was just kind of an outsider because people had been working before, you know, for years without national support and
it's the
recognition.
History that, for example, even to this day, Rosa Parks will say, you know, there was a long chain before I actually did
a
what I did.
A long chain, and those are the people, you look at common people, those are the people who are actually making history. And in both these books, The People's History of the American Revolution and The First American Revolution, my premise is that common people are making history. They are always acting on their own behalf. Sometimes their actions have immense consequences. In The First American Revolution, I show that those consequences, common people acting on their own, started the American Revolution a year before other people started it.
You're now, shifting things away, though, and I'm not saying I'm making a judgment here. Don't misunderstand me. You're shifting things away from the idea and the necessity to believe in leaders.
Well, exactly. And now I'm saying history works this way. People think, well, leaders. If leaders do things, then who's everybody else other than the leader? A follower. And that's the concept of a political dynamic. Leaders do things, everybody else follows. I say people act in their own behalf. These people, in the process of doing that, some leaders emerge and start expressing things, and they exert certain power this way and that. It's a dynamic interrelationship between leaders and others. And if you want to look at how history actually functions, you see often people are in the forefront, and leaders kind of like voice that and are given all the credit for that. Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill. A lot of other people put it on the table a lot before he did it.
Can I give you another analogy?
Let me just finish that. Yeah. The same thing with the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers were very important. That's what I'm trying to get at. They were politicians. And they were very erudite, and they lucid, and they were very excellent writers. And they certainly deserve credit for their role in putting things together. But where was the stuff of what they put together? The stuff was coming from the people, and from the grassroots. And you can't just forget that.
Can I just bring in, for the sake of my own self-indulgence, a couple of popular culture metaphors that might serve us here? I was reminded of when I interviewed Brenton Marsalis, and he said, everybody thinks that the lead singer of a band is the most important person in that band, and he's really in some ways the least important. It's the band and every single instrument that's playing. Or the idea that the quarterback, and of course quarterbacks are important, is somehow more important than the guy who's centering the ball and blocking for that quarterback. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really your view of history. And it's a difficult history, I think, for a lot of people to digest. It's just not how we're conditioned to look at history.
And actually, I'm starting to work on a project now called How History Forgets. And what I'm looking at here is...
I like the title.
Yeah, is the how the narrative structure of the way we write history leads away from people's history, because we want to write our stories with individual protagonists, even down to the level of the end of each sentence has to have a subject and somebody has to do something. So we want a name, and we're looking for that name. Now, in this First American Revolution, this incredible story about the farmers in their mud cake boots overthrowing the British in 1774 before Lexington and Concord, I don't have a protagonist. And believe me, I wanted one. I looked far and wide. I combed every research library in Massachusetts. I got a lot of great information. But these people were not like John Adams, writing every night and preserving his stuff and aware of his place in history. And so I can't develop that one protagonist. So what we have to have is we have to have a history with a group protagonist. And people aren't used to that.
That sounds neo-Marxist to people. It's collectivist history
collectivist
as opposed to
history.
Individual history.
It makes people feel uncomfortable. Yeah. They'd rather have the nice, warm, cuddly figure that they can identify with. But I'm sorry, if you want real history, you're going to have to go with groups of people interrelating and acting in concert with each other, because that's the way history functions, not just a few bright men dreaming up and conceptualizing history and all the rest just following along.
How would we then on Independence Day honor those who have created this great nation in terms of the spirit behind it and the collective wisdom of the many who fought to bring it into being?
Well, this is self-serving, but I'll say one way to honor it is to start reading people's histories. Start reading... start getting it. Listen, I mean, I've devoted the last 10 years of my life to looking into the people's history of the American Revolution, and before that, I've been doing basically people's history from California, from the basically history from the bottom up. But that's really where it starts. It starts as if you're looking at history, try to get beyond the famous people and look at who else is going on in history and what they're really doing, and you're gonna retell the whole story. The first American Revolution, the people's history of the American Revolution, are my attempt to do that. But you can do that in the Second World War. And, well, there's a lot. Let's take the Second World War.
What are all these politicians going to do, though, who keep quoting our founding fathers and talking about the spirit of our founding fathers?
Well, they darn well should read about the common people, because they would do well to read that the founding fathers are common people. They would do well. The politicians should read it. You know, this is not a political story, by the way. I mean, unique. The right wing should love this story. We have militiamen taking over from an oppressive government. Right wing's going to love that. And the left wing's going to love it. We have grassroots democracy, participatory democracy, leading to the overthrow of the British government. Middle-class people can love it because these were property-owning people making a revolution. So politicians should like, actually, the view of history from the bottom up, because it refers to all the people, and they claim to represent the people.
This is one of the most ingenious self-promotions I've heard. Ray Raphael telling you, whoever you are, you will love this book, and not only love
this book,
but go buy it, and in that way, show your real patriotism on this July 4th. Actually, I'm going to give a plug for it, too. It's really great reading. People's History of the American Revolution, and the newer one, The First American Revolution, which is before Lexington and Concord. Ray, been a delight to talk to you.
Well, it's been great to be here. I love to talk about patriotism in the real sense.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much. Happy Independence Day to all of you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. This has been a special pre-recorded edition. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.